We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Muslim ladies from all around the world, welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite program. Well, this is Asma, your service as the host. And just like always, we have Sister Zainab in here. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Walaikum assalam. Thank you so much.
So it's such a pleasure to be here with you again. How are you doing?
Alhamdulillah.
So it's very good. Well, before any introduction, I would like to get into the very main discussion of today's episode. Previously, on Muslim Lady, we talked about the preparation of the gatherings of the holy month of Muharram, of how we could get prepared for this month. We said that there are some preparations on the part of the host, and there's some preparation on the part of the person who is going to get into those gatherings. Now, since we're talking to all the Muslim ladies, well, we would want to know how a Muslim lady would get into those gatherings in order to have some benefits from them.
Since we talked about how we can prepare for Hassani Majlis or these gatherings, now I guess the point, like, since this program is dedicated to Muslim ladies, how can women actually benefit from these gatherings? So first of all, participating in these gatherings requires, like, they can attend these gatherings and they can organize these gatherings as well. So they can listen or they can deliver sermons. They can recite laments. Mm-hmm. They can, you know, get the chance of distributing food and charity. Or even sometimes, like, if we have a lot of people right now in these special days who visit shrines. So women are not barred from that particular thing that they can even visit shrines. So, yeah. So
These gatherings could happen in the shrines or in the mosques as well?
Yeah, anywhere. Hussaini Masjid can take place at anywhere, yeah. But we talked about that. Just talking in general, globally, we have some 51.3% of women who are introverts. So definitely when you are introvert, you're very shy to express yourself outside. So this Hussaini Majlis gives you a chance, you know, because this introvert woman, again, according to, you know, many health professionals, researchers, yeah, they tend to have a higher sensitivity towards emotions, a richer imagination, and a deeper appreciation for beauty and art. But at the same time, they're introverts.
That's very nice.
So these women have a best chance to express their, like, poetic and artistic nature at these gatherings.
Very nice.
They can write and recite poems about Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family, their sacrifice, their legacy, their relevance, you know, and to commemorate.
And to share them with others.
Exactly. So that's one form these introvert women can actually benefit from this. Because when we say introvert does not exactly mean they don't like to talk to anyone at all.
Yeah, but
at
they're least, isolated and yeah, they hate other people.
Exactly.
They don't like to talk to
them.
That's
why I said, like, introvert women at the same time, if they are introverts, but what kind of tendencies do they have?
Exactly.
So when we say they are shy to express, that's maybe they are shy to express, you know, in the external world, in the not in front of women. So these gatherings do provide a platform for such women to, you know, express their artistic nature.
Exactly.
So it's a powerful way of, you know, communicating emotions, your values, the messages that, you know, resonate with others. it's not just the poems, but it's also the, like, we see in these gatherings, which are like women special in the Muharram, women, we also hear them reciting Quran, hearing Quran, listening to Quran, you know?
Exactly.
Supplications.
So let's keep it in here, go for a short break, and then we'll be back to follow the rest. Yes, as Sister Zainab was just saying, by the way, you're listening to Muslim Lady and I'm Asma. Well, we're talking about how to benefit from the gatherings of the holy month of Muharram, and Sister Zainab is actually telling us how. Well, at the very first point you said that it could be a platform for all the introvert women. And there was a nice percentage. I didn't know about it at all. It was quite a large number of women in this world are just introverts. So there could be a platform for them to share poems, commentaries, or anything for other women to benefit from. And also, you were talking about a platform to recite the Holy Book of Quran together.
Right. So it's not just, you know, you can express only your poetic part, and not all women are poets.
Exactly.
So, you know, you recite to Holy Quran, you listen to Holy Quran, which in itself is about it, worship.
So, well, I could say all the women are poets.
Right. Supplications, nohas, which are the laments, you know, that mourn the tragedy of Karbala and praise the virtues of Imam Hussein al-Islam and his companions. So even this, I won't say this is not an art. Like you said, all the women are kind of poets.
Because the language of heart is the language of women, and all the women could be considered as poets.
You know, releasing your grief and sorrow and your emotions through the lyrics and a kind of, you know, music is in itself an art.
Exactly.
So, you know, through nohas we do that.
Yeah.
So there are many women who are fondful of, you know, they want to sing, but this hand, you know, reciting nohas in a woman gathering gives them that opportunity to, you know, not to get suffocated.
Well, just
let's to express
just
themselves.
Give a little definition for a little explanation for the word noha for all those people who do not know what it is. Well, in these female sort of gatherings for the holy month of Muharram or for any tragic event, women gather together, there is no non-mahram among them, and then what happens is that a single woman gets in front of the others, and then she starts reciting poems in, we don't say that it has got music, but, you know, they just, as if they're singing a poem for all the women in front of them.
These nohas, when you hear to them, when you recite them, they inspire you to follow the example of Imam Hussein al-Islam. I remember when I was a child and I didn't know anything about the story of Karbala, these nohas were actually the lyrics of these nohas were
exactly.
Something that would help me understand the tragedy of Karbala or the virtues of Imam Hussein al-Islam and his companions. So apart from these things, you can, as a woman, you know, as I said, that this is the best platform to express your artistic nature. You can make or even admire the artworks that depict the scenes and symbols of Karbala, you know, such as paintings, such as drawings, such as calligraphy, and we sometimes even have embroidery or, you know, sculptures. You know, when we attend these Hussaini Majlis, you will see some women. I personally have seen that, like in our culture, people would do that. They would make the banners and they would write Ya Hussein with this thread themselves.
Yeah, so, which is beautiful.
So, that's again another form of art you can, you know, express. The
so they can bring all their abilities into manifestation.
I gifted my sister a shirt. Even that shirt had written this Ya Hussein on it. But that was done with hand. So I know this embroidery, this artwork, again, can be, you know, expressed in these majalis, because as we said, in the preparations of this, these majalis or these gatherings, mm-hmm. you got to be preparing, you got to be, you know, decorating your rooms with that black
exactly.
banners and those artworks or those, you know, calligraphy, those paintings. So that also depicts your artistic nature, even though if you're an introvert.
Yeah, that's very true. Apart from reciting all those poetries and also going through some religious facts as they go for the Holy Book of Quran. Well, as we get into those gatherings, these women who are preachers and who have been through some studies and they are actually experts in religion, they come and they bring out some points from the Holy Book of Quran, and then they would describe that for all the women in order to enlighten them more and more.
Right.
So I guess it's the best time for us to go for a short break, and then we'll be back. So don't go anywhere. Stay with us.
Countless voices crying mourning, weeping with grief and pain. Had I a sword, I would defend the veil of Zainab. Countless voices crying mourning, weeping with grief and pain. Had I a sword, I would defend the veil of Zainab.
Welcome back. This is the last part of today's episode of Muslim Lady. We're talking about how to benefit from the gatherings of the holy month of Muharram. Well, actually, there are a lot to learn from these gatherings.
It's a way of learning, teaching, and remembering the history of Karbala and the lessons that we derive from it. These gatherings are a best way to connect to the history,
yeah.
culture, our faith, and also, you know, to cope up with those challenges that mm-hmm. we face in our personal life and at community level.
Yeah.
So these women gatherings do play an important role in expressing, you know, women can express their devotion, the unity, the, you know,
well,
identity as Shia Muslims.
Speaking of unity of these Muslim ladies, I remember when I was a kiddo, well, we were living in an apartment, and in that apartment, every year when we were getting close to the holy month of Muharram, all the women gathered together in one of the houses, and then in there, we started to cook cookies together. Now, just imagine all the mothers together and us as the kid were just helping them. So it was such a beautiful gathering. So even behind the scenes, we have too much of these unity that you were just talking about. So all the women come together and all these Muslim ladies try to show all their art in their cooking
souls.
And things like this, and
right.
then they start to share all those foods with the poor people.
Right, they contribute to the
exactly.
even to their culture by, you know, just spread, you know, just distributing the food. They're contributing to their own culture, because
exactly.
in these gatherings, you may have people from all different cultures, which is in itself another.
And at the same time, you would care for your neighbors, you
right.
know, because through these gatherings, you would come to understand what problems your neighbors are suffering from. Then you might lend them a helping hand, you might do something. So it's just a matter of, you know, communication, unity, getting to know each other more and more,
right.
sympathizing with each other, being each other's shoulder.
Right. So if you're an introvert woman and you have you're shy to express yourself in the outside world, these gatherings are the best places to, you know, express yourself these ways. But the very important thing that all the women should keep in mind in these gatherings is that, you know, when we start, as I said, that there's Quran recitation, there's this supplication, there are ziyarah, and there's no majlis wherein you won't say, Assalamu ala al-Hussein wa ala Ali ibn al-Hussein wa ala awlad al-Hussein wa ala ashab al-Hussein. You know, you pay salam, you pay salutations to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions. Why? And what does that mean? When you enter this majlis this way, this gathering, you should not come out of this majlis the same way. When you're expressing your salutations, that means when you say salam, salam is the word which is also derived from the word of Islam. It all means submission. So you're submitting to your imam.
Yeah. So at the same time, there's another lesson for you.
Exactly.
To know
so
that you have to listen.
The way you're submitting to your
exactly.
imam, now you're expressing your salam. When you say you surrender in front of him, you submit to your
and you should manifest it in your lifestyle.
Then you should not be coming out of this majlis the same way.
Exactly.
In itself is a life-changing lesson when you enter this majlis.
Yeah, so just to give the gist of what we were talking about as for today's episode, I could say that there are many things to learn from these gatherings of the holy month of Muharram. And also there are many things to benefit from, many knowledge that could be shared in those gatherings for all the Muslim ladies to make the best out of them. Some of the women are in search of just some points to work as a, you know, as a miracle in their life. Sometimes those moments of sparkling in your mind would happen through these gatherings. Somebody says something that you never thought about it, or they would draw your attention towards it, and then you would get to know yourself more and at the same time try to change your life in a better way. And yeah, that was all the time that we had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, I bid you farewell and I leave you to God's never sleeping eyes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
For thought. Salam and condolences to you on the 8th of Muharram, when the Prophet's household was deprived of water from the river Euphrates by the enemies of humanity in a vain effort to force Imam Hussein, peace upon him, to endorse the illegitimate rule of the godless Yazid ibn Muawiyah. The March of Karbala's answer is indeed food for thought. By Allah, I will never give you my hand in allegiance, like a man who has been humiliated, nor will I flee like a slave.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The story of chaos. Part 1.
If you had access to the list of the largest employers in the world in the early 20th century, you'd probably see that only the armies of different countries would top the list as 10 largest employers. There was a time when the armies of countries were the largest employers. For example, during the Crimean conflict in 1853, the Russian army had 2 million soldiers, and in the final days of the Second World War, the number of US Army soldiers had surpassed 11 million. But after the major wars were over, for many countries, the policy of large armies didn't work anymore. the governments quickly moved to shrink their military institutions. The fundamental change sent a massive torrent of unemployed workers to the market. During the next decades, the capitalist economy attracted a large number of the job seekers. Today, if you take a look at the list of the largest employers, you'll see the names of multinational private companies like Walmart, the owner of the largest chain retail corporations whose revenue is $415 million. It is known as the largest company based on revenues. The Foxconn electronic industry company, when you use desktop computers, or when you take a picture with your cell phone, or when you're playing a digital TV game, you're using a product the company has a role in producing it. However, you'll see a company on the list that you wouldn't believe it would be so large. G4S has been registered as a security services company. After Walmart and Foxconn, it ranks the third largest private company in the world with 620,000 employees. The number of the employees in the company is three times larger than the soldiers under the British command and equal to the Israeli regime army personnel. G4S has defined its mission as providing security services all across the globe. Its services run a large gamut, from night watch to transferring prisoners, from transporting money and gold to setting up private prisons, from the security of airports to fire stations, from armored vehicles to establishing order in concerts and festivals, from protecting oil installations and ports to detaining and deporting migrants, from security services in the 2020 Olympic Games in London to war.
For over 30 years, G4S specialist training has provided governments, businesses, and individuals with the skills to operate safely and effectively in demanding and complex situations. Forming the world's largest training team of former UK Special Forces personnel, our trainers' elite skills and real-life experience give you the confidence to operate in any environment, anywhere in the world. From the varied terrain of the UK to challenges presented by any demanding environment across the globe, we are able to adapt our courses to meet the specific needs of our customers.
Shocking now.
Whatever your training needs, you can be sure that G4S will enable you to demonstrate the intelligent application of skills and information that creates safe and secure operational environments.
In the northern part of the equator, on the shores of the Gulf of Guinea and the Atlantic Ocean, there is a crowded land, a country with a population of over 200 million people, is the seventh most populated country in the world. Nigeria, the land of oil, cocoa, and of course, poverty. The oil wells and gas resources in Nigeria have placed the country among the top 10 fuel exporters, yet people earn a very tiny fraction of the natural resources. Over 70% of the people live in abject poverty with an income of less than a dollar a day. As you move further towards the Muslim majority areas in the country up north, the crisis deepens. Foreign companies exploit the oil and gas in the country, but people get nothing from the share they pay the Nigerian government. Poverty coupled with injustice begets anger and protests. If the inheritance is handed down to the next generations, the outburst of rage might lead to insecurity. Insecurity is the most important factor for security services companies. So a little insecurity was enough for the largest contractor in the country to drag G4S to the Delta region in the south of the country in the absence of a powerful government. Chevron, an American company that has a large share in extraction and sales of oil in Nigeria, has faced rebellions by local people and villagers near the oil refineries and platforms since 2002. After the opposition movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta was formed, some of Chevron's staff were taken as hostage and the oil pipelines were targeted in sabotage attacks. That was the time when the directors of the giant oil company forced the Nigerian government to give the thumbs up to a security firm based in South Africa. Gray Security Services hired unemployed locals in Nigeria and trained them to use arms to counter insecurity. After a while, the company was forced with G4S. Speedboats equipped with machine guns were used to patrol the oil platforms on the rivers adjacent to the Niger Delta in the Gulf of Guinea. Chevron personnel would be commuted to their workplace with the escort of G4S agents who had firearms. Even when hungry and poverty-stricken women in that region occupied an oil refinery in protest to the corruption and environmental hazards, the company's anti-riot forces violently dealt with them. People in Nigeria unwillingly host the security services company, but they're not alone in this. In Africa, especially in the central parts on both sides of the equator, there are many children who do not even have proper clothing. They don't have schools. And the more young adults and adults try to find a way to make ends meet, the less they succeed. Deep-rooted chaos and insecurity, which lead to tribal conflicts in these countries, make the governments or foreign companies who have come to Africa to exploit the natural resources ask private security firms to help. Companies from China and India to Britain and the US. People in Congo still remember that during the insurgency by the Katanga separatists against Patrice Lumumba's national government in the 1960s, hundreds of mercenaries and fighters were deployed to that part of Africa by security services. Some people like Irish Mike Hoare, known as Mad Mike, or French Bob Dennard, called the Scary Gang. But for the local people, it didn't make any difference whether the mercenaries from G4S or other corporations were in their countries to restore peace or make money. People in Africa hate them, either because of their dark colonialism heritage and presence of white, blue-eyed soldiers, or because they see that foreigners pocket huge amounts of money amid the abject poverty of the people in the region. For them, the personnel of security services corporations are simply mercenaries. But mercenaries haven't been so detested. In the Middle Ages in Europe, being a mercenary was considered honorable. But we shouldn't forget to mention the key ideological role of the Christian Church in restoring credit to the hired soldiers. But when the very mercenaries failed to restore security to Jerusalem and were expelled by Anushtagin, their honor Gold coins and the sanctity were all gone. In the final years of the Crusades, when the Ottoman Sultan Mehmed tightened the siege on Constantinople, a group of Italian mercenaries led by a renowned Genovan leader campaigned to the Eastern Roman Empire through the Mediterranean. When the Justinian ships and their mercenaries passed through the Bosphorus Strait and entered the Byzantine realm, people showered them with flowers and glory. However, when the Ottoman Sultan entered the Hagia Sophia Church, no one had seen any Genovan for a while. The son of the Roman Empire said, "At the same time with the emergence of modernity, national governments rose across Europe. As Europe approached the final years of the 19th century, the harsh nationalistic slogan became more fervent, and national armies were formed with new equipment. They immediately rushed into the First World War." But soon, the racist slogans faded away and the mercenaries were dragged into the war. One day, East India Company soldiers passed through Khuzestan, Hamedan, Kermanshah, Urmia, and Khoi in Iran and moved towards the Ottoman Empire. The next day, the African soldiers of the French army fought against the Germans. The First World War got the East Asia to the West Europe engaged. Denmark announced neutrality and was saved from the bloodshed and fire. Danish companies provided weapons and ammunition to both sides of the battle. During this period, their businesses flourished. The high number of casualties and the depression that followed the war seriously depleted the armies of all sides. In 1901, a textile merchant established Copenhagen Friedrich Night Watch security firm with 20 employees. By taking advantage of the First World War, he earned a whopping amount of money. No one really knows what happened to the company during the Second World War and the occupation of Denmark by the Nazis. But after it stepped into Britain in the 1950s and was forged with four British corporations, a larger company named Four was formed. Four was born right before a new era, the Cold War. Security was a pivotal issue under the shadow of the Cold War. Intelligence security and counter-espionage activities, suppression of left-wing riots in the Eastern Bloc, and assassinating suspicious elements, moles, and dissidents were of great significance for sides of the conflict. London was the heart of the intelligence security war in Europe. The espionage era had helped security services corporations flourish. Britain hosted many companies besides Four. Those years, the representatives of private security services companies were in touch with the covert and overt security companies to get instructions from their employers and sent James Bond to Eastern Bloc countries to make roadblocks for the enemies and foil their operations. Although many of them might not be as lucky as 007 and might not always be in luck to succeed in strange missions, and not remain unscathed thanks to a last-minute miracle. The collapse of the Eastern Bloc in the last decade of the 20th century was not the end of private security firms. The lucrative business survives on security, and now it was their turn to take part in wars. At the turn of the 21st century, West Asia was invaded by American and British forces. After toppling the governments, restoring security and establishing new order created a new market for the companies. It was during those years of war and the occupation of the Middle East that four that had expanded through operations forged with another security firm named Securicore, and all of a sudden a giant was born. Securicore has been established in 1935 to provide night watch services in British neighborhoods and streets. After it teamed up with Four, it became the largest private employer in the world, which was named Group 4 Securicore, or in short, G4S. G4S was a giant that needed to achieve success in the chaotic situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. The company increased its personnel to 400,000 people. At the same time, it seriously got involved in the wars in West Asia. The value of its stocks increased by leaps and bounds, and its annual income hit $3.7 million. Now, after nearly 20 years, it's obvious that although local people and the hot zones have not benefited from handing over security affairs to private firms, the directors and stockholders have earned a lot of money. But despite the presence of the companies, security was never restored to the region they were involved in. The casualties of private contractors reached unprecedented figures because of their increased presence. In the beginning of the war, the casualties of the private companies comprised only 4% of the total casualties of the soldiers. But in 2010, the US and the firms suffered the same amount of casualties. In general, 1/4 of the casualties under the U.S. command were from the private companies. Although armies and companies are not forthcoming in publishing the figures on the firms, so their businesses won't be exposed to risks, as the casualties rise and as larger number of private company soldiers get killed, who can ignore a market that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars?
IRIB English Radio in the month of Muharram presents today's special. Every day for 15 minutes.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Dear followers of IRIB English Radio, dear listeners of today's special, Salamun Alaikum and welcome to this episode of today's special on Muharram. Today we're going to speak about Aliyul Asghar. Today, Wednesday, 8th of Muharram, 1445 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri Calendar, corresponding to the 4th of Mordad, 1402 of the Islamic Solar Hijri Calendar, and the 26th of July, 2023 of the Christian Gregorian Calendar. on the sad occasion of the martyrdom of Ali al-Asghar, we offer all of you our condolences and invite you to listen to this episode of today's special about Ali al-Asghar, the youngest martyr of Karbala.
عظم الله أجورنا وأجوركم بمصابنا بأبي الأحرار سيد الشهداء أبي عبد الله الحسين وجعلنا من المنتظمين بمصابهم مع إمامهن منصورهن من آل محمد.
Abdullah al-Asghar ibn Hussein was the youngest child of Hussein ibn Ali and Rubab. Rubab had two children, Sakina and Ali Asghar. The fact that Imam took with him a newly born baby further demonstrates that his intention was never to engage in any armed rebellion. At Karbala, Asghar was only 6 months old. He is honored by Muslims as the youngest martyr of Karbala. When most of Hussein ibn Ali's companions had sacrificed their lives, there was a cry heard. It was Hussein who was calling for anyone to help him. He reminded his enemies that he was the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny. Hussein ibn Ali was called, and when he came, he saw the thirst that was gradually killing Ali Asghar. Therefore, he asked permission of his wife, who was the mother of Ali al-Asghar, to take him to the battlefield and ask his enemies for water.
Imam Ali alayhi salam in Sermon 192 in Nahjul Balagha talks about this. It says, but Allah tries his servants with various ordeals and obligates them with various forms of struggle and tests them with various dreads. So there's struggle, there are dreads, there are ordeals. But there's a purpose why Imam Ali says this. He says there's a purpose. إِخْرَاجًا لِتَكَبُّر مِنْ قُلُوبِهِمْ to in order to eradicate vanity from their hearts, takabur and arrogance, the same attribute of Satan, to take the Satan away from us, to make us humble. Wa iskanan litadallul fi nufusihim, to take away vanity from their hearts and instill humility in their souls. And that this may open the doors to his favor and the feasible means to his forgiveness. Allah is making us, instilling humility in us. Allah is taking away arrogance from us. And that is what the purpose of our life is, to be an abd. Don't we say in our salat, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan abduhu wa rasuluh, that I bear witness that Prophet Muhammad is his slave first and then is his messenger. Being a slave of God is the greatest quality of our Prophet. And that is how we reach him and connect to him. Not by arrogance, not by doing whatever our nafs wants, because our nafs is our greatest enemy. By actually taking away ourselves from the nafs and the lower desires into just submission. As the traditions say, religion Islam is huwa taslim. The religion of Islam is nothing but submission to God. And this submission itself brings us so much power, gives us so much strength, gives us such great favors, that a person that becomes a true slave, a true servant of God, becomes the most powerful person, becomes the most able to manage their pains and difficulties, because they see themselves as a student of Imam Hussein, They see themselves, when trials and tribulations happen, they see themselves as being tested, and they want to pass this test, just how Imam Hussein alayhi salam passed his test and even amazed the angels with his patience. We want to pass this test. So in this Muharram, that we are understanding bala, this great bala that happened on Imam Hussein alayhi salam, we reflect on our own lives, and we say that we want to be able to, just like our Imam, just like our master Imam Hussein, dealt with his pains, we want to become like him. How did he deal with his pain? The solution is he was an abd. He understood that this bala is for a purpose, and that purpose is to increase him more in ubudiyat, in being a slave of God, in being humble in God, and to take away everything else besides God in his heart. Inshallah, in this Muharram, we can learn to become a greater servant of God, a greater slave of God, and this is the key to dealing with trials and tribulations and difficulties in our life.
On the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family and companions, be with today's special. Every day from IRIB English Radio.
People rise up and mourn, it is Ashura. See the struggle of Hussein in the Kabbalah.
This is today's special from IRIB English Radio, and this question: why did they, the enemies, kill Ali Asghar in Karbala? Ali Asghar was only 6 months old in Karbala. He was the son of Imam al-Hussein and Rubab. On the day of Ashura, it was very hot and there was no water for the family of the Imam for 3 days. His mother could not feed him either, as there was no milk. When the Imam called out, "Is there anyone to help me?" there was loud crying from the ladies. The Imam came into the tent. Hazrat Zainab said, "Oh, my brother Hussein, since Asghar heard your call, he has not stopped crying." The Imam said, "Bring him to me. I will take him and see if he can get some water." Rubab brought the baby Ali Asghar from his crib and kissed him goodbye. Imam Hussein took the baby in his arm and, going to the army of Yazid, said, "See how thirsty my Asghar is. His lips are dry and he can hardly open his eyes. He has done no harm to anyone. Give him some water." Hearing this, some of the soldiers started to cry, but Umar Sa'd said to Harmala, "Stop Hussein's words." Harmala aimed an arrow at the baby's neck. The arrow hit its mark and the baby was killed in the arms of his loving father, Imam al-Hussein. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, please accept our condolences on the sad occasion of Ali Asghar's martyrdom.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Abdullah. وعلى الأرواح التي حلت بفنائك عليك مني سلام الله أبدا ما بقيت وبقي الليل والنهار فلا جعله الله آخر العهد من زيارتك السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين الذين بذلوا مهجهم دون الحسين عليه السلام
The Martyrdom of Hazrat Ali Asghar, narrated by Ayatollah Khamenei. If a home's electricity goes out for 2-3 hours during the summer, parents won't be concerned about themselves. But when a mother sees her child restless, finding it difficult to sleep due to extreme heat, her heart burns in despair. Now imagine the event on the afternoon of Ashura in the camps of Imam al-Hussein, under the scorching heat, all so thirsty. For this little infant, some abstained from drinking out of the remaining water in that scorching heat. Suddenly, they weren't thinking about themselves when they watched little Ali Asghar. I assume the main reason Imam al-Hussein brought Ali Asghar to the enemy's army to ask for water in order to nourish the infant, while there was very little hope that these lupine enemies would have sympathy and give the baby water, was that Imam al-Hussein had no other option and there was nothing he could do to help. When the Imam moved about the tents, he noticed the air was filled with anguish and much commotion. This small infant's thirst, hunger, and distress had moved everyone. Hussein ibn Ali had to take the baby in his arms, although there was very little chance the enemy would give the baby a cup of water to soothe his thirst.
Imam Hussein As-Salam is alone. There is no one left with him. He knows that it is his time. He cries out one more time. Is there anyone to defend the sanctity of the Messenger of Allah? The only people who are left are women and a young baby by name Ali Asghar alayhi salam and his son Sajjad. Imam Sajjad, when he realizes that there is no one there to help his father, he is the one who leans on a cane and comes out of the tent dragging a sword. He is so weak, he cannot carry this sword. He was so sick, he could hardly move. Imam Hussein, when he sees that Imam Sajjad has a sword in his hand, he cries out to his sister Umm Kulthum, saying that, no, do not let him come out. احبسيه لألا تخلو الأرض من نسل آل محمد. Do not let him come out. Let not the earth be deprived of one of the descendants of the family of Muhammad. He orders the dependents to be silent and to stop crying. He bids them farewell. He gathers together his clothing and he puts on the proper clothing that he will know, because he knows that he will be looted. And then he orders that his infant son be brought to him so that he can bid him farewell. He takes his son into his arms and he says, let me try once more to get water from the enemy. He goes to them and he tells them, do you not know that I am the son of the daughter of the Prophet? Do you not hear that the Prophet said about me and Imam Hassan that we are the leaders of the youth of paradise? And then he looks at his son, who is crying out of severe thirst, and he says, Ya qawmu, in lam tarhamuni farhamu hadha at-tif. If you will not have mercy on me, then at least be merciful on this young child. Someone fires an arrow and it hits Ali Asghar alayhi salam on his neck. Imam Hussein alayhi salam cries out saying, Allahumma ahkum baynana wa bayna qawmin da'awna liyansuruna faqataluna. O Allah, just between these people and between us, they are the ones who called us to help them and now they are killing us. Imam Hussein alayhi salam looks around. He looks to the right and he looks to the left. He sees no one there to help him. He begins to say, La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-aliyya al-azim.
As-salamu ala al-murammali bid-dima'i. As-salamu ala gharibi al-ghurabai. As-salamu ala al-Husayn wa ala ansari al-Husayn. As-salamu ala al-Husayn wa ala ansari al-Husayn.
Condolences on this month, the Muharram, and today, the martyrdom anniversary of Ali Asghar. Peace be upon him.
Allahumma ij'al mahyaya mahyaya Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa mamati. ومماتي ممات محمد وآل محمد.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
headlines, Iran blames Israel.